Good evening and welcome. I'm Kelly Richards, CEO of the All Access Group and the host of All Access Radio. I've spent over two decades as a catalyst and trailblazer in the digital music and entertainment arena. As a super connector, I create powerful alliances at the nexus of technology and entertainment, bringing together leading innovators, entrepreneurs, and forward-thinking creative artists. And as a trusted advisor, I work with high achievers as a strategist and coach, ensuring they have the insights, expertise, support, and connections they need to create greater impact and more meaning in their work and in their lives. Tonight's guest on the show is Elaine Dennis. Elaine is an experienced designer and brand advocate and the founder of Ink Studios, an arts advocacy firm, representing a variety of artistic works and artisan brands, which connects creatives to creative avenues to more widely showcase their work and tell their stories. Elaine has directed creative marketing campaigns for such iconic worldwide brands as Apple, Adobe, Levi Strauss, Match.com, and Sony, and she's collaborated on tech-related endeavors with artists like Herbie Hancock, Carlos Santana, Metallica, Seal, Thomas Dolby, and other entertainment industry luminaries. Elaine is also the co-founder of the Graphic Arts Institute Technology Lab in San Francisco, and she's been recognized by the Academy of TV Arts and Sciences, or the Emmys, the National Recording Academy, the Grammys, and Communication Arts Magazine for outstanding contributions. Welcome to the show, Elaine.
And thank you so much. It's great to be here with you this afternoon, Kelly. I'm just always impressed with all that you do. So thank you for inviting me.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind. You know, I like to start sort of in a linear chronology way, but of course we're going to talk quite a bit about our time together at Apple. Perhaps you could start by sharing a little bit, Elaine, with our listeners about some of what inspired you as a young person to move in the direction of creating the career that you've done to this point?
Well, I would have to say that it was really my environment growing up. I grew up in a family surrounded by mathematicians and artists alike, including entrepreneurs. So there were great discussions. Also, you know, there was a lot of music in the home. We were fortunate to be able to study the arts, and, you know, I studied piano at age five and took ballet, and I think that that's really what made me kind of naturally gravitate to things that are kind of left brain, right brain. So technology,
right.
The intersection of technology and the arts, and certainly music.
It's interesting. We both kind of grew up in an environment like that, which I think stood us in very good stead for the time that we crossed paths at Apple. And for our listeners' benefit, you know, we did wind up working closely together at Apple during the 90s to drive the initiative with the music industry. And I think you would agree it was certainly a career high point.
Oh, absolutely.
and maybe you could share a little bit about how you got your proverbial ticket to Oz. That got you to Apple.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that was an incredible time, and we'll never forget it. I actually moved out to Mountain View from Boston literally a week after the Loma Prieta earthquake. And at the time, I was working for a prominent design company, Letraset, which I also worked there with Lisa Wellman, who had then joined Apple as well. And so I was involved in desktop publishing and came to work with the folks in Apple Creative Services, and as they were using the suite of tools from Letraset for designing their materials there. And so I worked really closely with them. I eventually ended up moving out to Silicon Valley, as I said, and Photoshop came out and killed our product. And so I got laid off, and I got an introduction to Eric Zarikoff and evangelism, and started working. I was initially hired to work on evangelizing the TrueType format, which was, interesting partnership between Apple and Microsoft to avoid PostScript. But then I ended up working on QuickTime 1.0 with that development team in the Advanced Technology Group and produced the first developer tool CD. And that was pretty crazy.
That was an incredible time. Yeah.
From there I just went on to work on, more advanced formats of the QuickTime tools and things like that, and which eventually led into VR and toolkits and webcasting and relationships with the music industry. So
it all kind of wove together, and then our paths crossed when I was working with Lisa Wellman, who, by the way, I just interviewed for this radio show a couple weeks ago.
Oh, she's great.
Very interesting timing
lady.
On so close together.
I know.
But do you have a story from your time during those days at Apple that you feel demonstrates the unique culture of the company and some of your contributions, Elaine?
Wow. Well, I would say, it was just, starting with the QuickTime, development, which was kind of, it was a skunkworks project in ATG with an incredible team of talented engineers.
By the way, our listeners don't know what ATG refers to. That was the Advanced Technology Group at Apple, coming up with all the next generation cutting edge things, essentially what would be the Johnny Ive group today.
Right, and they had no marketing or monetary things driving them. They were just kind of allowed to go off and think up things, and I think that to me is like the moxie of Apple, as you talked about, which is just forging ahead on things that people have not even thought of yet. I mean, I think at that time, really, that was being developed, people were just trying to get their heads around things like Photoshop, and it really was a game changer. And initially, people didn't even want to put the movie player on the System 7.0 CD that was coming out, and we somehow got it snuck into an extras folder. So, I think it's just things like that sort of and look at where QuickTime is today. It's really kind of, just this ubiquitous format for media. And so it's just kind of incredible to see see things like that just kind of bubble up and just...
Yeah, and pivoting off what you shared there, I like to say that what we did with the music, people say to me, well, gosh, what did Apple do in music before iTunes? And I'm so proud of us having been pillars and bookends for having shared the vision of how important music would be at Apple and for Apple's customers and for the artists that we were serving. We were so early on that vision, but we had
Absolutely.
It. Absolutely. Yeah, that's right. We did amazing things during those years.
During that time, we really did build some solid relationships there. We talked and collaborated with the music industry, from the actual musicians and artists themselves to showcasing, tools that we might be doing, like the ECD, the Enhanced CD Toolkit at that time. I mean,
and you remember the Masters Media campaign, and when I was so proud to walk the music brochure over to show you all those stories collaborated on. I mean, little things like that, but they were so pivotal when you look back.
Yeah, I mean, amazing. I mean, because we were working within limitations of, the technology and where the industry was at that time, with distribution and rights issues. And then, of course, we also had to tiptoe around the Apple Music issue, which,
we had our three-page memo from the Apple Records side of the Beatles company, that all three pages of what we could not do in music, because we kept losing those lawsuits until Steve came back and won it.
Right. No, exactly. That talk about moxie, too, is just like, he was the one who originally had started that off with the Beatles.
That's right. We had to clean up the mess, which we couldn't do very effectively, and then he came back to clean it up once and for all.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, the Beatles was the last holdout on iTunes, and yet that was his favorite group. So it was interesting. I mean, we really you know, we avoided lawsuits during that time.
Well, we sure did, but we also blazed a lot of trails. Now, you and I both worked with a lot of artists during those Apple days, and you in particular, you know, had some interesting experiences with the likes of Carlos Santana and Herbie Hancock and Metallica. What was your experience like in working with some of those artists? Is there a story that stands out? I mean, I kind of remember you with Seal doing some interesting stuff.
Yeah, well, yeah, actually, he was really working in tandem with us on creating content that would be used in a, you know, enhanced CD environment, and then we would gradually, you know, we were getting into the webcasting. But yeah, I mean, there were so many things when we did the music industry briefing where we started to talk about how we wanted to develop a relationship with the industry and provide these tools and technologies to enhance the user experience or, you know, the fan experience. And that's I met Herbie Hancock when he attended the Music Industry Forum that the QuickTime Group hosted in the mid-90s to talk about some new tools. And, you know, and he was just a trailblazer in, you know, music and super into technology and just an inspirational individual. And, you know, to this day, I mean, I've worked on, you know, different projects with him. I consider him a friend. And, you know, I think that was one of the things that I feel really blessed and grateful to have had a chance to work with not only the amazing people like you at Apple and the technology folks there, but also to have met some of these, you know, really incredible global forces like
we both share the privilege of having had those relationships, some of which started then, and that we both have been able to nurture and continue to this day. Certainly Herbie for both of us, people like Thomas Dolby, you know, my years with Todd Rundgren, all of those artists were very much right where we were in the alignment of the vision that we shared about what was possible with these tools. But we were all very early in the game compared to when the consumer side finally took off with iTunes.
Oh, yeah, and I think that a lot of these artists that were looking to, you know, work with us or find out about it, them were really, you know, pioneers as well and looking to the technologies to really kind of communicate their messages, you know, more globally, you know, through their fan pages or their content or what have you. But, yeah, Seal was definitely one of those folks. And, you know, and Santana also partnered with us, I think, on the – it was the first QuickTime Live webcast that was with Bill Bradford.
Was that the one that was done with the Digital Club Network with Michael Dorff and Andrew Ruscha?
That was actually just before that with the – you mean the Macintosh New York Music Festival stuff that spun out of that. Yeah, this was actually – we did a press conference for QuickTime Live brand in San Francisco, with which Santana was the headliner of the San Francisco New Year's Eve event, and Bill Graham Presents was in partnership with us, and we sort of kicked off the webcast there, and we had Web Central set up there, and then that kind of expanded into doing things like the Macintosh, you know, it wasn't called the Apple New York Music Festival, but the Macintosh Music Festival in New York, which was with, you know, Michael Dorff, who I know you've interviewed on your show. And also Andrew Ruscha, and then some other things came out of that, which were real high-profile things, such as the Grammys webcast, which was pretty big at that time to be doing, because that was a really music-specific event that was super, you know, high-profile, and, you know, people all over the world were tuning
exactly
in
right.
That.
And oddly enough, to cross-connect some of those dots, Michael Green, who was the president and CEO at the time, just reached out to me maybe 2 weeks ago, a month ago maybe, and after disappearing for many years. And Port now, who has been the CEO for many years of the Grammys, was actually, I don't think you knew this, was actually my boss at EMI before I started at Apple.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's
that's
all one degree of separation.
Totally. I mean, it really is.
And somebody recently It must be Mercury retrograde, Elaine, because somebody recently forwarded me this video I hadn't seen in 25 years, because it was 25 years ago that I started at Apple after leaving EMI on the music stuff. And it was the original video we did to launch MIDI with Laurie Anderson and Herbie and some of those guys.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm not even sure you've ever seen that. Have you seen that?
I don't think that I have.
I think I've got to send you the link for nostalgic purposes, which I will do.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I have the video that we did for that QuickTime 2.0 launch at the American Film Institute, which was Dave Nagel riding Sajeev Chahil on the back of his Ducati through the information highway to the stage of the American Film Institute, which was, you know, looking back now, that's the kind of stuff that, you know, Apple just was hilarious at creating their own content for these.
Well,
things,
yeah,
so.
And Lisa Wellman and I were reminiscing about that. You remember the Kauai Institute thing that I did with the American Film Institute with Toby?
Yeah.
Digital storytelling, and Lisa and Carlos Montavo were responsible for being sponsors of that event, also in conjunction with the American Film Institute. So those relationships were really solid, and we can take great pride in helping Apple, you know, launch and nurture those.
That's right. Absolutely. Because, you know, these people were already, you know, a lot of the industry was really primed with what things were possible, and you know that always spawns ideas for new products and things that come out, like music services and music players and things like that. You know, I mean,
and frankly, forming a dialogue and a friendship and a partnership with a lot of those very worthy institutions that I think have served Apple and been beneficial to them in return for many, many years now.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, segueing on from Apple, tell us a bit more about the artist advocacy work that you do at Ink Studios and what Ink's focus is, Elaine.
Oh, great. Well, you know, basically, it's again kind of being an evangelist for the artists that we represent and the nonprofits that we work with. Artists, as you know, tend not to be the best marketers or spokespeople, so we really help them show their work, get their story out, collaborate with them on things that, you know, they might not otherwise have exposure to for their art. So I guess to help them better communicate their work. So, for instance, we've done work, you know, on contract with all the major studios and have gotten some great placements for a variety of our artists on primetime television shows and, you know, in film, but the television shows have been especially rewarding because, you know, these are things that, for example, on HBO Entourage in the Mansion set, we had a lot of Robert Altman's photographs of, you know, Mick Jagger and George Harrison.
It's placement. Is it, it's placement in that context?
Those are our clearances and placements, that we went out, we've gone out and showed our portfolio to some of the folks, you know, in the entertainment industry that work on these shows. And so they're like set decorations.
Right.
And that's really great because you've got, you know, a great big audience. But if you could translate it back to, you know, the actual original piece selling, that's even better. But, you know, it's great to be able to have work on shows like Californication and Leeds that are part of a permanent set. And then, you know, we also have hosted a lot of affairs for things like independent films, emerging musical acts, and, you know,
And this segues into some of the stuff you've done for Sundance, the film festival as well, right?
Yeah, that I've worked on the last several years through another placement firm in Los Angeles that has produced the music lodge at Sundance for the last 10 years, and has been in partnership with Fender and, you know, in years prior to that, other companies like Gibson. And so that's been a place to showcase and bring in both technology partners, brand partners, and artists that are actually, you know, in films, but also want to get on stage and jam. So it's
right.
kind of been one of those places, as well as a big press venue.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's back.
And
in
you're also the co-founder, as I understand it, of the Graphic Arts Institute Tech Lab in San Francisco. Tell us more about that and what inspired you to get that in motion.
Well, actually, yeah, that is something that took place kind of during the desktop publishing days when all of the tools were sort of converging and the traditional print media wasn't necessarily oriented to how do you get these digital files from a designer that's handed you a disk from a Mac to print out from this five-color press that you have. So it's kind of going back to those days. And what we did was, you know, we put in place a whole technology lab because the Graphic Arts Institute at that time was serving, you know, the print industry, and it was a school to keep up on, you know, the latest tools. But at that
yes.
time, this was the convergence of those worlds. And so we established the technology lab there. I did that in partnership with the head of the Graphic Arts Institute, a guy named Steve Whaley. And we rallied together the companies that provided solutions in that area digitally, like Apple and Adobe. We got, you know, at that time, and this is, you know, kind of going back into the 90s, you know, the tools that were available for the digital side, scanners and all kinds of things to be able to show, hey, this actually works, being able to get a beautiful five-color image to print from a digital file to this five-color
lab. Right.
So,
and does that,
you know,
does that group still exist to this day, or has it moved on?
Yeah, they have dissolved because of, you know, the print industry and sort of that was a need at that time. But, you know, people were coming there and learning all the tools of Photoshop. You know, that was sort of at that time the desktop publishing area was more of the cutting edge than,
yeah,
you know, digital film and music. And
it's
things
interesting
like that.
How
so,
these have come in waves as
yeah.
the technology has moved on. But I wonder if you could
do.
Share sort of your thinking in general about what your experience has been like as an ambitious woman in the tech arena in Silicon Valley, which, as we both know, is not as balanced when it comes to women really thriving.
Right, yeah. Well, it's still a very male, you know, dominated industry, the tech industry is. And, you know, I cut my teeth on Wall Street in the late 80s, and, you know, that was right out of college. I worked there for Ross Perot's company, ADP, in the marketing department. And I traveled all around and worked, you know, in these firms that were switching over from Quotron systems to this other system. And anyway, so, I mean, I dealt with a lot of men in that world. So before
and,
I
of course, both of us
found
come out of the music and tech worlds, which are both heavily male-dominated.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess, you know, I think I just tried to stay, to know my stuff, and if I didn't know my stuff when I was dealing with, you know, I dealt, as an evangelist, I dealt with engineers, marketing all the way to the executive levels and, you know, as you know. And then, if I didn't know something, I tried to learn it as fast as I could and ask questions and to listen and not, you know, be afraid to assert myself. And, you know, so I just say that, you know, I think if you're the best thing to do is just be respectful, to show up and present, you know, and present, to be present, know your stuff, and try not to get too emotional and personalize things. And, you know, I think that that's the best way to
yeah.
just sort of, you know, and also to have mentors, I think is really good, whether they're women or men. In especially, you know, in this industry, and to mentor others. And along my way, I mean, when I was working in evangelism, I was the first evangelist at Adobe, I was hired in there, and I worked for a woman, Tracy Stewart. And, you know, there were all, it was, you know, there were men and women in the group, but the engineering and ATG groups were definitely, you know, mostly all men. And they would send me on trips to developers to go see them on my own, to go talk with the engineers. And so she really kind of, you know, helped to help me work through, you know, just being, knowing your stuff and presenting it and talking, you know, being able to bridge the gap between what one company or you know, a department may want and another. So you're just kind of trying to, you know, communicate without, you know, just being direct, I guess, is the thing.
Yeah, and actually crossing invisible boundaries. Like, you know, at Apple there were a lot of fiefdoms, and I can recall from the business group going over to get input from the QuickTime group and on the marketing pieces we were doing, and people didn't really encourage that, you know. There was these silos, and so being able to kind of ignore and bypass a lot of that, and the gender issues as well, and just doing a professional job and demonstrating respect and listening and getting input and collaborating, I think are all very, very powerful attributes. But I'm wondering, you mentioned you think mentoring is critically important, both to receive and give. And I wonder if you could kind of expand on that a little bit, why mentoring is so critical.
Because I think that, you know, otherwise you're kind of, it's good to have all kinds of different mentors, I think, in our lives, from our professional lives to our personal lives and, you know, our spiritual lives, and just sort of, you know, wisdom is an important thing, and that's something I think that mentors really help, can help us out with, you know, if you have a mentor, and also mentoring someone that's, you know, maybe less experienced than you, because it's really helping people kind of guide them through something that, you know, if you're just going it alone, it's much harder to do than to bounce things off somebody that's been there. That's, you know, another great mentor for me has been Dan Lynch, who's, you know, been a pioneer in the, you know, internet area with his Interop, and you know, he came into my hemisphere I don't know, probably like 15 years ago, and he's a delightful person, a good friend, and has been a great, valuable mentor to me. And I think that, you know, it's important, and I felt like I got mentored from different people that I worked with, but also, you know, just sort of in life in general, there are people that you, you know, cross paths with. And I would say Herbie Hancock is one of those people who, you know, he's just got a lot of wisdom and a beautiful spirit. So
that's for sure. You know, and I think you're right. I think it's important to, I mean, I must say I'm biased because it's a big part of how I work these days is as a trusted advisor to other people. But it is important to guide and support people in living their passions and living in authentic alignment with what they want to be doing with their lives, and helping them perhaps avoid some pitfalls, sharing some insights, sharing some strategies, some wisdom, as you put it, and, you know, just basically supporting people in getting out of their own way and hopefully avoiding painful mistakes, whether they're personal or professional.
And that's such a great thing that you do. I mean, mentoring is a wonderful, it's just wonderful. I think everybody should have, you know, mentors because, like you said,
behind
I mean,
success.
Help them get out of.
Yeah, I think it's a key for any successful people. Ask any successful person you know, have you had exposure to mentors in your history, past, you know, personal or professional? And I'm certain that almost everyone would say they have. So
it's vital.
It's a worthy thing.
Absolutely.
Now, what are some things you foresee, Elaine, shaping the immediate next generation future of tech? Where do you see things are headed? What's impacting that?
Well, you know, I mean, it's interesting because we've gotten, you know, so into this peer-to-peer, and, you know, I just see that being, you know, there's just becoming more extreme where there's just, you know, more bartering. It's just, you know, like you're just exchanging with other individuals and removing models for, you know, structures and money exchanges. And, you know, eventually by the sheer ubiquity of technology and users, you know, things will become, they'll be free or something, you know. Eventually there will not be apps that you buy or, you know, devices. This is something that, you know, as the individuals are kind of converging peer-to-peer. That's sort of how
that certainly is a phenomenon that we've witnessed taking shape for a while. And I also think, do you agree that wearables are a huge trend in terms of what's coming next with tech?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's just sort of, you know, because especially with the products from Apple, they've been so, the brand has just been so, you know, much something that people really feel identifies them. And now, you know, having wearables, it's like, you know, we've had personalized, you know, with our phones, you can, you know, have different colors or whatever. But now I think, you know, we're going into a whole new area with that. So I think it's going to be very interesting to see, and, you know, I look forward to
to
that. But I look forward to the idea of driverless cars and dogs carpooling themselves to doggy daycare. You know,
well,
I think that's going to be really crazy when you see that happening, and it's not
that
far away.
Yeah, no kidding. And we'll know we're in the future when that's really entrenched. But it's a good segue to kind of talk about some of the broader aspects of your life beyond the tech side. I mean, I understand and I know that you've served over the years on several nonprofit arts organizations, including music in schools, music in the schools. Could you tell us a bit about the organizations that you have gotten behind and why you feel they're important to get involved with?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. Music in schools, I got involved with them when I was at Apple Computer. I think got the introduction to them through Bill Graham Presents and probably through that SFNYE webcast event. I actually think that's when it happened. So we're talking about, you know, mid-1990s. So Music in Schools has been serving the, you know, Greater Bay Area public schools with music programs and mentors, music mentors in the schools for over 25 years now, and it's just, you know, incredibly important work. And unfortunately, these programs often get cut by budgets. So Music in Schools helps to supplement that, and, you know, they're involved in research projects and just sort of advocating the importance of music in early on in children's lives and the important
values. Which many of us were privileged to have, but as you say, cuts have really impacted the arts.
Yeah, I mean, we were privileged to have it. A lot of kids just don't have access, and that's where groups like Music in Schools today, Grammy in the Schools, you know, the Fender Foundation, by providing, you know, some guitars and instruments to the schools.
There was that VH1 Save the Music campaign to do the same. There have been a number of these, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
When a child picks up an instrument early on, it just feeds their need for creative expression and collaboration. You know, it just brings into lives more harmony and also leads to better comprehension of other things, including languages and math and, you know, all kinds of subjects in school. So
exactly right.
You know,
yeah.
I think it's important. It helps, you know, children become connected if they're, you know, playing music with a group or, you know, in their school, and it makes people feel good. So,
I think you hit the nail on the head with that last point. You can't underemphasize music's impact on a child's self-confidence.
Absolutely, and it's a universal language. I mean, when you travel, you know, to other countries, and, you know, these kids are all singing the songs, and, you know, from the artists. It's just, it's you know, I think it's really a shame that it's not more available. But these vital organizations, you know, do great work. And so, you know, as much as I can, I really support the kinds of organizations like music and schools.
I really applaud you for taking the time because, again, these are nonprofits. They typically can't. And it, you know, our time is limited, but the fact that you feel so strongly that you've been able to get behind it is a real feather in your cap, in my book. And,
thank you.
Oh, another passion I know that you have is dogs, and maybe you could share a little bit more about what you've done with dogs. You had a commercial endeavor with dogs, right? You were doing some toys and collars and stuff.
Yeah, well, actually, we're working on that right now. But, you know, I think that that's another thing that kind of comes with, you know, animals are real healers for people. And I think that we live, you know, we have a lot of violence and people are isolated. And there's just so many things that, you know, I mean, when you look at, the statistics, I mean, there's more guns in this country than there are people that live here. There's, you know, there are, you know, a lot less instruments in the homes, and there's a lot less pets in the homes than there are guns in homes.
Stalking.
I think there's something wrong with that, you know. So
you're right.
Give somebody a dog because, or any kind of pet, because, you know, that's really where, you know, certainly people who have had post-traumatic stress, you know, there's comfort there with, you know, animals just are, and they know from, you know, and I know from my experience, but a lot of people know, but they've also done studies that, you know, the love and the, you know, the unconditional love, and also just the fact that if you have a dog, for example, you're outside exercising. I mean, it just leads to people feeling better, happier, and being healthier. And I think, you know, I mean, I'd rather see people go out and, you know, have to adopt a dog instead of being able to go to the store and get a gun.
Oh,
that's,
I couldn't agree more.
And
so many benefits to being an animal, to being a pet owner. For yourself as well as for the pet. I myself have always had pets, and I've got wonderful large male cats that are my children that sit with me right now as we speak. I'm fortunate to be able to work from a home office, and one of the perks is that I'm with them all the time, and it does something to your soul that you just can't really explain, but it's absolutely vital.
Well, it's like the interconnectedness of all life, you know, and that, you know, all living things. And so, I mean, we're all connected, and that is, you know, energy. And it's, well, as you know, I mean, it's comforting to us and to them as well. And so,
you know, I share your philosophy, but tell our listeners a bit more, Elaine, if you would, about what you're doing with dogs and your work with them and the products you're creating.
Well, like I said, I mean, I think that all, you know, animals are just great for our sense of peace. They can bring us peace and comfort and, you know, take us out of loneliness. And so, you know, we're developing, you know, just whimsical lines of you know, our products along our own brand for from Inc. that incorporates some vintage elements and things like that. So those are just kind of fun stylistic things. But also looking at down the road, trying to put together some, you know, kinds of documentaries about these healing creatures and just other things that help heal us and make us feel good. Like, you know, obviously music is one of those things, the arts. And, you know, I thought it was really lovely what you wrote in your blog about Robin Williams. I think you called it Lessons on a Legend.
Yes.
Is that right? Yeah. And it just was about, you know, trying to make the world a better place. And I think for me, that has to do with, you know, happiness and people feeling, you know, compassion for one another. And so I think, you know, changing the world.
And pets and music are both big keys to that in our lives.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we
the fact that you've spent so much of your energy and life force in those arenas is a testament to part of, I think, your legacy in the world and your contribution and everything you've been about.
Well, thank you.
But, you know, before we wrap up our time together, I do like to ask what I think is probably one of the most important questions of every guest, and we might have touched on it already, but it's what comes next for you as part of your legacy. What is there a project or a collaboration that you've not yet started that we haven't talked about that you dream about creating and kind of rattles around in the background all the time?
Well, you know, that's such a great question to put out to your guests, and I thank you for that because, you know, it really, there are those dream projects that you think about and, you know, you wonder, do I have the courage to do it? And, you know, I think one of the things that really sits hard with me is the amount of violence and the tremendous suffering, you know, of individuals, not to mention countries that we have in our time. And I think, you know, it starts within each person is to develop a, you know, the self-love and to, you know, basically be based in compassion for one another.
Right.
And I would love to collaborate with like-minded people on any number of spiritual leaders or, you know, people like that, that would perhaps incorporate music, you know, technology and a, you know, holistic component that really looks to helping one another, you know, be more peaceful and loving. So,
a very worthy,
I mean,
objective.
The objective.
The
world,
I have a feeling if anybody can pull that off, you'll be a big part of it. But
well, you know, you
how can folks contact you if they want to, Elaine? What's the best way for them to learn more about you and reach you if they want to?
Oh, great. Thank you for asking. Just my first name, Elaine, and that domain is at inkit, inkit.com, which stands for, you know, individual self-expression in all its shapes and forms.
And inkit is obviously also the website for your company. So,
yes, that's correct.
Great.
So,
well, I want to
yeah.
thank you for taking the time out to join me tonight on the call. It's been such a pleasure to sort of traipse down memory lane a bit with you and also to be able to share some of your great works with the listeners of the show. So thank you very
much.
Well,
thank you so much. I'm honored to be here, and it's always great talking with you. So thanks again.
My pleasure, Elaine. And thanks to our wonderful listeners who join us here each week, as well as to my show producers, Mary Agnes Antonopoulos and Jessica Masters. We'll hear you all again next week on the next edition of All Access Radio. Good night, everybody.